The following program is not a production of Audio Journal. External programs like this are selected with the interests of our audience in mind and with the goal to inform and entertain. The opinions expressed in this program do not reflect the views and opinions of Audio Journal, its board of directors, staff, or volunteer readers. Thank you for listening to Audio Journal.
Hi, my name is Billy, and today I'll be reading you National Geographic for the Talking Information Center. This reading of National Geographic comes from Friday, July 17th, 2026. And over to our first article, Why Strength Training Advice for Women is Mostly Wrong. This was written by Hannah Singleton. For decades, women have been told they need special workout rules. Don't lift too heavy, train around your hormones, change your workouts throughout the month. The advice seemed logical. Men have substantially higher testosterone levels, a hormone that plays a major role in muscle growth. Testosterone increases muscle mass in boys, so you get an adult 20-year-old man and an adult 20-year-old woman. And there's going to be differences in baseline muscle size and strength, says Lauren Colenso-Semple, a researcher and science communicator specializing in female physiology and exercise. But a growing body of research suggests those differences may matter less than many people assume once training begins. A 2025 meta-analysis published in PeerJ found that women have a similar capacity for muscle growth, known as hypertrophy, as men. While men typically start with more muscle mass, women make comparable relative gains in muscle mass through resistance training. Once people start exercising, the sex differences disappear quite quickly. When you think about lifting weights and the magnitude of muscle size and strength that you can gain in response to training, the trajectory is very, very similar in men and women, says Colenso-Semple. Although hormones can influence how exercise feels from day to day, there is little evidence that most women need entirely different training programs to build muscle, strength, or fitness. That matters because resistance training remains one of the most powerful tools for improving cardiovascular health, preserving bone density, and supporting healthy aging. But only 27% of adult women in the U.S. met the federal guidelines for muscle strengthening activities in 2020. Here's what you need to know about how women should be training. Why hormones have become central to the conversation. The idea that women should train differently from men didn't appear out of thin air. Most exercise science research, specifically on resistance training, centered men as study participants, leaving many women wondering whether their own physiology had been adequately considered. We have a menstrual cycle. We have highs and lows of estrogen and progesterone, much more drastic than men have changes in their testosterone levels, says Heather Milton, an exercise physiologist and course and certified strength and conditioning specialist who teaches a program on perimenopause and menopause for NYU Langone Health. Energy levels, sleep quality, recovery, and mood can all shift throughout the menstrual cycle, making it easy to see why many women feel that their workouts shouldn't feel the same every day of the month. One of the clearest findings so far relates to perceived exertion, how difficult exercise feels. If I'm to do the same workout now than I do in my late luteal phase, I might think that it was a really intense workout. But currently, if I did it today, I might feel like it was a breeze, says Milton. It doesn't necessarily mean that we have to completely change everything we are doing phase to phase in our menstrual cycle, but being aware of it or of that is very helpful. But understanding why a workout feels harder isn't the same thing as having evidence that a training program should change. What social media gets wrong. In recent years, social media influencers, coaches, and wellness companies have increasingly promoted the idea that women should tailor their workouts to different phases of their menstrual cycle. These cycle syncing programs may encourage women to lift heavy during one phase, for example, and swap strength training for yoga, walking, or recovery-focused workouts during another. Researchers, however, haven't identified an evidence-based protocol for making those kinds of adjustments. It's more for us to understand as women, why did that workout feel like it sucked, says Milton. But feeling worse during a workout doesn't necessarily mean the workout is less effective. Women can still build muscle, lose fat, improve cardiovascular fitness, and even perform just as powerfully throughout every phase of the menstrual cycle. In some cases, rigid cycle syncing programs may even work against long-term progress. Frequent reductions in training, volume, or intensity can make it harder to stay consistent with strength training or to accommodate enough work to drive meaningful adaptations. What if we want to optimize our ability to adapt to exercise is consistency, says Colenso Semple. Many strict cycle syncing recommendations also oversimplify the menstrual cycle. Only 13% of women have a 28-day cycle, which many programs are based on, and symptoms can vary dramatically from person to person and month to month. Colenso Semple argues that bad actors in the wellness space have capitalized on the historical underrepresentation of women in exercise science. They profit on selling ineffective solutions to women because when you employ one strategy that doesn't work, guess what? They are right there waiting to sell you the next one, she says. They don't want you to adopt the habits that actually work, because they can't monetize that. What differences actually have evidence behind them? While many popular claims about sex-specific training haven't held up, researchers have identified a handful of physiological differences that may be relevant. A 2020 meta-analysis in the Journal of Strength and Conditioning Research and a 2023 review in the same journal found that women and men both responded similarly to resistance training in terms of muscle growth and lower body strength. Even untrained women had a higher capacity to increase upper body strength than men. That doesn't mean researchers haven't identified any sex-specific considerations. One area of growing interest is how hormonal fluctuations throughout the menstrual cycle may influence recovery and injury risk. Milton says that some research suggests an increased risk of ACL tears during the luteal phase. More research is needed to pinpoint why this increased injury risk may occur, but Milton says that during the luteal phase, progesterone rises, which increases cortisol response and inflammation. I don't want that to be a red flag and worry people. Our cortisol levels ebb and flow, which is totally fine, but it can also mean that we may need a little bit more recovery time, she says. Still, she cautions that the evidence remains preliminary and is more relevant to athletes participating in high-intensity sports than the average gym-goer. But having something that is actually evidence-based that can allow you to have a reason to take a rest day or a lower intensity day, I think is very valuable, says Milton. Women also appear to be more fatigue-resistant than men during certain types of exercise. Studies suggest that women often perform more repetitions at a given percentage of their one repetition maximum, 1RM, than men do. In practice, that may mean a woman can complete more repetitions at 80% of her 1RM than a male training partner, even if both are following the same program. This may help explain why some women find percentage-based strength programs less accurate than expected, or why they need slightly higher repetition ranges to reach failure. The science is still evolving. After years of debate, the biggest takeaway may be surprisingly simple. The fundamentals that drive fitness adaptations, progressive overload, adequate recovery, consistency, and proper nutrition work similarly across sexes. It's not a male versus female, says Milton. It should be tailoring their workouts depending on their medical history, their fitness, and their goals, not just what the media is telling you you should be doing. However, Milton cautions that researchers still lack sufficient high-quality data to draw firm conclusions about how hormonal fluctuations influence training outcomes. She says that the next generation of research is moving beyond the question of whether women can train like men and instead asking whether exercise programs tailored to female physiology could produce even better results. Until researchers have that answer, the evidence suggests that most women can focus less on optimizing around their hormones and more on the fundamentals of getting stronger. And over to our next article. What extreme athletes learn when they push to the limits. This was written by Chris Ballard. A quick disclaimer. This article contains strong language. Please be advised. In September of 2019, Sarah Thomas, a then 37-year-old marathon swimmer from Colorado who was still recovering from breast cancer, pulled off one of the most remarkable feats of athletic endurance in modern history. Thomas began by swimming from England to France. Upon arriving, she touched a rock and a few moments later turned around and swam back to England, whereupon she touched a seawall and again returned to the water. After arriving back in France some 40 hours after she began her swim, Thomas, by now sleep-deprived, swollen from sea salt, stomach in open revolt, did something that's hard to imagine. She returned to the cool, dark water and made for England. The next day, more than 54 hours after beginning her swim, Thomas arrived at on the shore of Dover, bloated, caked, intestine, leery-eyed, and barely able to stand, the first person in history to complete a four-way crossing of the English Channel. If anyone can explain the psychology of endurance, it should be Thomas. Only, as it turns out, explaining it is far different from living it. When people think of endurance sports, they often picture ultra-marathons, those sufferfests where competitors hurtle on through day and night, downing carbohydrate gels, taking 5-minute power naps, and grinding away until toenails fall off. To make it through, runners turn to different strategies. Ultramarathon champion Courtney Dowalter, a former science teacher in Colorado, famously enters what she calls the pain cave, envisioning an actual cave and herself in a hard hat, wielding a chisel, going to town, trying to make it a dust pile where I am there. Scott Jurek focuses on detaching from negative thoughts and embracing a flow state. Then there are the sustained feats of endurance, like the one attempted by the aptly named Marathon Monks of Mount Hiei near Kyoto, Japan, who run the equivalent of 1,000 marathons in 1,000 days in a quest to reach enlightenment. Those who succeed are honored as Daigyomin Ajari, or saintly master of the highest practice, revered for the extraordinary discipline and spiritual insight. But the marathons aren't even the hardest part. In one part of the trial, known as the Dori, monks must sit in constant prayer for nearly 10 days without food, water, or sleep, all under round-the-clock watch. During this phase, the monks say, the line between life and death becomes paper thin. Battling the depths. Wanting to push your limits is one thing. Getting your body to comply is another. Given the millennia of evolution have instilled a host of built-in biological kill switches in fail-safes. When I went searching for information, one of the first names that show up was Tim Noakes. A South African sports scientist, Noakes coined the idea of a central governor, a subconscious control center that monitors the body's internal signals and steps in to slow us down before we reach true physical danger. According to Noakes, we almost always stop well before we are actually out of energy. The brain's job is to protect us from ourselves. Noakes argued that this central governor acts preemptively, long before metabolic catastrophe strikes, limiting effort in anticipation of damage. If this sounds like a useful trait, well, most of the time, it is. It's what protects us from injury and calamity, unless, that is, you are purposely trying to push beyond those limits. Doing so requires finding a way to bypass or override that central governor, and as it happens, swimming provides a revealing canvas for exploring this quest. It's at night when the demons come out, those deep insecurities and self-limiting beliefs. Unlike running, climbing, and cycling, which offers external stimuli in the forms of terrain, scenery, aid stations, and other competitors, distance swimming is radically internal. You can hear virtually nothing. You stare down into murks for hours, days at a time. The sensory deprivation can be overwhelming. The earliest marathon swimmers have no issue overriding their regulator because they've already risked their lives with each swim. Unlike in running, you can't just stop and walk if you get tired in the middle of the ocean. Walk the beach in Dover, and you'll come across a statue of Matthew Webb, the first person successfully cross the channel unaided, a swaggering barrel-shaped British merchant seaman. Webb pulled it off in 1875 when shipwrecks and deaths at sea remained common. As a former sailor, he understood the risk intimately. While working on the Cunard line ship sailing between New York and Liverpool, Webb dove in when another sailor fell overboard. Though he couldn't save the man, the selfless act drew acclaim, and Webb won a prize from the Society for the Recovery of Persons Apparently Drowned. For this channel attempt, Webb wore a red swimming costume and slathered himself in a porpoise oil to guard against the cold. He breaststroked the entire 21-mile distance, fueling himself with beef tea, cod, liver oil, and regular swigs of brandy, and other energy drinks handed to him by crewmen in a support boat. In the end, it took Webb nearly 22 hours to complete the swim, during which he dodged jellyfish and tides in creeping hallucinations. By the time he staggered ashore in Calais, barely able to stand, he had become an international sensation, and he lived out the rest of his days chasing grander and grander feats in the water until his final stunt, attempting to swim through the whirlpool-ridden rapids below Niagara Falls, proved fatal. His epitaph read, "Nothing great is easy," a fitting summary of the sport he helped launch. 50 years after Webb, Gertrude Erdely became the first woman to cross the channel, famously leading to one of the largest ticker tape parades in the history of New York City. 5 decades after her, Lincott showed up as a teenager to set a speed record. By the time of Sarah Thomas's four-way attempt, a quartet of swimmers had successfully made a three-way crossing, an American, a Brit, a New Zealander, and in 2015, Australian marathon swimmer Chloe McCardle, who spoke afterward of the long nights of the swim. It's at night when the demons come out, those deep insecurities and self-limiting beliefs. Thomas battle more than most. The marathon monks view endurance as a gateway of sorts. The idea is to exhaust the body and mind until nothing is left. When Thomas and I connected via Zoom, she told me that she first booked her channel attempt in 2017. She viewed it as a retirement swim of sorts. She was coming off years of open water feeds and are about to set the world record for the longest continuous unassisted in current neutral swim in Lake Champlain, an astounding 104.6 miles. Having already crossed the channel, she now wanted to return to take a run at history. She booked a tide window 2 years out. Only 8 months after booking her slot, she was diagnosed with an aggressive form of breast cancer. 16 rounds of chemo, a mastectomy, 25 rounds of radiation. She kept swimming through much of it, dragging herself to the pool between infusions, even when she could barely lift her arms. It was the one thing that made me feel normal. By the time of her tide window in September 2019, her hair had only just grown back. Normally, Thomas could get in a zone where she swam, lost her own thoughts, what many open water swimmers call a moving meditation. The longer you are out there, the quieter everything gets. But after her mastectomy, doctors had put in a tissue expander as a temporary placeholder, lacking the time for another surgery before the channel. She had to swim with it in. It's like having a softball attached to your pec muscle, she said. Super uncomfortable. It also forces her to adjust her stroke, her right arm acting all wonky. The result? I tell people that I remember every single moment of the English Channel, because I couldn't get into that flow state. I was very present, and I did not want to be very present. The wisdom of slogging it out. In my conversations and research on endurance, a theme emerged. While the how may be hard to fathom, it's nonetheless relatively easy to explain. It involves muscle tissue and mantras and feed strategies. The why of it, that's the trickier part. What draws someone to override the brain's central governor to push past the point where every system screams for them to stop? For some, it's about learning through failure. That's the idea behind the Misoji Challenge, or at least the modern interpretation of the Japanese tradition, taking on something hard, say a marathon swim, in which the odds of success are intentionally set around 50%. The premise, by pushing that limit, we learn the most about ourselves. The marathon monks view endurance as a gateway of sorts. The idea is to exhaust body and mind until nothing is left. At that point, as one of the monks explained to a journalist, when you are nothing, then something comes up to fill that space. That something, the monk said, is the vast consciousness that lies below the surface of our lives. That manifests differently for different people. Marathon swimmer Elaine Howley told me the story of her first swim to Catalina off the coast of California coast. I was terrified when I started, she said. You are launching at like 11 o'clock at night, jumping off a perfectly good boat into the middle of the Pacific. And there's things with teeth that live there. When she faltered during the long nights, her friend Howley jumped in to swim alongside her, yelling, "We don't make decisions in the dark." The idea? Never do something rash in your lowest moments. She continued, "As I just watched some flying fish go by, and they were being chased by sea lions. And then, of course, my brain goes to what's chasing the sea lions. But then she got in the water and caught some bioluminescence. Every time I put my hands in, I would get Star Wars warp speed lights off my hands, and I would be absolutely mesmerized. The lights pulled her out of her fear and into a space where I was like, this is so cool. The world is a pretty amazing place." She paused. And for me, it's such a good metaphor for life. I mean, life is hard. Life sucks sometimes. But then you get these moments of just sheer wonder and awe and beauty. And it's like, okay, I can keep slogging. Or, to put it another way, the more hard crap you do, the easier it is to do the hard shit. Thomas agreed. During the four-way crossing, salt water blasted up her nose and down her throat as she fought the current, too fatigued to breathe properly. She nailed a jellyfish with her face, and when she faltered during the long nights, her friend Howley jumped in to swim alongside her, yelling, "We don't make decisions in the dark." The idea? Never do something rash in your lowest moments. "You have to give me until sunrise before you quit," Hallie said. "Then see how you feel." That became Thomas's internal motivation. This sucks right now, but the sun will come up in a few hours, and we'll be fine. She pushed through, the sun rose, and then went down again, and then rose again. When she hit land in England, just after dawn, 54 hours after launching, a crowd awaited, though the point-to-point swim is technically 80 miles due to current and tides. She actually covered 130. She celebrated with a glorious handful of peanut M&Ms. And over to the next article. Was Molly Pitcher a real person? This was written by Aaron Blakemore. During the darkest days of the American Revolution, women followed their husbands into war, aiding American troops with much-needed water and medical care, and bravely fighting alongside male soldiers during key battles. In American folklore, a woman nicknamed Molly Pitcher typified the grit and courage of these women who selflessly provided comfort to soldiers on the battlefield. Historians now believe Molly Pitcher is a historical myth, a composite folk figure who embodied the wartime experiences of multiple real-life women. Female volunteers played an important role on Revolutionary War battlefields, even though they were barred from formal military service and largely unrecognized for their efforts. And looking at the time, that's all the time I have for today. My name is Billy, and I've been reading you National Geographic for the Talking Information Center. Have a wonderful day. And thank you for listening.
You may not be aware that there are many ways to listen to your favorite programs from the Talking Information Center. You may call us at 781-834-4400 to inquire about receiving a special TIC radio receiver. Or visit our website, ticnetwork.org, and click the Listen Now button on the homepage. Or listen through your phone by calling 425-585-1901. If you are a T-Mobile or Metro PCS customer, call 605-475-0129. Or listen on Amazon's Alexa. Simply say, "Alexa, play radio station Talking Information Center." Or listen on Google Home or Google Home Mini. Simply say, "Hey Google, play radio station Talking Information Center." Or you may listen by downloading our free app on your Apple or Android device. As you'll realize, there are many ways to access programming from the Talking Information Center these days. Choose the one that is right for you. If you would like any of this information repeated, please don't hesitate to call us at 781-834-4400, and we would be glad to assist you. Again, the number is 781-834-4400.
Hi, my name is Billy. And today I'll be reading you National Geographic for the Talking Information Center. This reading of National Geographic comes from Friday, July 17th, 2026. And over to our first article, Why Strength Training Advice for Women is Mostly Wrong. This was written by Hannah Singleton. For decades, women have been told they need special workout rules. Don't lift too heavy, train around your hormones, change your workouts throughout the month. The advice seemed logical. Men have substantially higher testosterone levels, a hormone that plays a major role in muscle growth. Testosterone increases muscle mass in boys, so you get an adult 20-year-old man and an adult 20-year-old woman, and there's going to be differences in baseline muscle size and strength, says Lauren Colenso Semple, a researcher in Science Communicator specializing in female physiology and exercise. But a growing body of research suggests those differences may matter less than many people assume once training begins. A 2025 meta-analysis published in PeerJ found that women have a similar capacity for muscle growth, known as hypertrophy, as men. While men typically start with more muscle mass, women make comparable relative gains in muscle mass through resistance training. Once people start exercising, the sex differences disappear quite quickly. When you think about lifting weights and the magnitude of muscle size and strength that you can gain in response to training, the trajectory is very, very similar in men and women, says Colenso Semple. Although hormones can influence how exercise feels from day to day, there is little evidence that most women need entirely different training programs to build muscle, strength, or fitness. That matters because resistance training remains one of the most powerful tools for improving cardiovascular health, preserving bone density, and supporting healthy aging. But only 27% of adult women in the U.S. met the federal guidelines for muscle strengthening activities in 2020. Here's what you need to know about how women should be training. Why hormones have become central to the conversation. The idea that women should train differently from men didn't appear out of thin air. Most exercise science research, specifically on resistance training, centered men as study participants, leaving many women wondering whether their own physiology had been adequately considered. We have a menstrual cycle. We have highs and lows of estrogen and progesterone, much more drastic than men have changes in their testosterone levels, says Heather Milton, an exercise physiologist and course and certified strength and conditioning specialist who teaches a program on perimenopause and menopause for NYU Langone Health. Energy levels, sleep quality, recovery, and mood can all shift throughout the menstrual cycle, making it easy to see why many women feel that their workouts shouldn't feel the same every day of the month. One of the clearest findings so far relates to perceived exertion, how difficult exercise feels. If I'm to do the same workout now than I do in my late luteal phase, I might think that it was a really intense workout. But currently, if I did it today, I might feel like it was a breeze, says Milton. It doesn't necessarily mean that we have to completely change everything we are doing phase to phase in our menstrual cycle, but being aware of it or of that is very helpful. But understanding why a workout feels harder isn't the same thing as having evidence that a training program should change. What social media gets wrong. In recent years, social media influencers, coaches, and wellness companies have increasingly promoted the idea that women should tailor their workouts to different phases of their menstrual cycle. These cycle syncing programs may encourage women to lift heavy during one phase, for example, and swap strength training for yoga, walking, or recovery-focused workouts during another. Researchers, however, haven't identified an evidence-based protocol for making those kinds of adjustments. It's more for us to understand as women, why did that workout feel like it sucked, says Milton. But feeling worse during a workout doesn't necessarily mean the workout is less effective. Women can still build muscle, lose fat, improve cardiovascular fitness, and even perform just as powerfully throughout every phase of the menstrual cycle. In some cases, rigid cycle syncing programs may even work against long-term progress. Frequent reductions in training, volume, or intensity can make it harder to stay consistent with strength training or to accommodate enough work to drive meaningful adaptations. What if we want to optimize our ability to adapt to exercise is consistency, says Colenso Semple. Many strict syncing recommendations also oversimplify the menstrual cycle. Only 13% of women have a 28-day cycle, which many programs are based on, and symptoms can vary dramatically from person to person and month to month. Colenso Semple argues that bad actors in the wellness space have capitalized on the historical underrepresentation of women in exercise science. They profit on selling ineffective solutions to women because when you employ one strategy that doesn't work, guess what? They are right there waiting to sell you the next one, she says. They don't want you to adopt the habits that actually work because they can't monetize that. What differences actually have evidence behind them? While many popular claims about sex-specific training haven't held up, researchers have identified a handful of physiological differences that may be relevant. A 2020 meta-analysis in the Journal of Strength and Conditioning Research and a 2023 review in the same journal found that women and men both responded similarly to resistance training in terms of muscle growth and lower body strength. Even untrained women had a higher capacity to increase upper body strength than men. That doesn't mean researchers haven't identified any sex-specific considerations. One area of growing interest is how hormonal fluctuations throughout the menstrual cycle may influence recovery and injury risk. Milton says that some research suggests an increased risk of ACL tears during the luteal phase. More research is needed to pinpoint why this increased injury risk may occur, but Milton says that during the luteal phase, progesterone rises, which increases cortisol response and inflammation. I don't want that to be a red flag and worry people our cortisol levels ebb and flow, which is totally fine, but it can also mean that we may need a little bit more recovery time, she says. Still, she cautions that the evidence remains preliminary and is more relevant to athletes participating in high-intensity sports than the average gym-goer. But having something that is actually evidence-based that can allow you to have a reason to take a rest day or a lower-intensity day, I think is very valuable, says Milton. Women also appear to be more fatigue-resistant than men during certain types of exercise. Studies suggest that women often perform more repetitions at a given percentage of their one-repetition maximum, 1RM, than men do. In practice, that may mean a woman can complete more repetitions at 80% of her 1RM than a male training partner, even if both are following the same program. This may help explain why some women find percentage-based strength programs less accurate than expected, or why they need slightly higher repetition ranges to reach failure. The science is still evolving. After years of debate, the biggest takeaway may be surprisingly simple. The fundamentals that drive fitness adaptations, progressive overload, adequate recovery, consistency, and proper nutrition work similarly across sexes. It's not a male versus female, says Milton. It should be tailoring their workouts depending on their medical history, their fitness, and their goals, not just what the media is telling you you should be doing. However, Milton cautions that researchers still lack sufficient high-quality data to draw firm conclusions about how hormonal fluctuations influence training outcomes. She says that the next generation of research is moving beyond the question of whether women can train like men, and instead asking whether exercise programs tailored to female physiology could produce even better results. Until researchers have that answer, the evidence suggests that most women can focus less on optimizing around their hormones and more on the fundamentals of getting stronger. And over to our next article. What extreme athletes learn when they push to the limits. This was written by Chris Ballard. A quick disclaimer. This article contains strong language. Please be advised. In September of 2019, Sarah Thomas, a then 37-year-old marathon swimmer from Colorado who was still recovering from breast cancer, pulled off one of the most remarkable feats of athletic endurance in modern history. Thomas began by swimming from England to France. Upon arriving, she touched a rock and a few moments later turned around and swam back to England, whereupon she touched a seawall and again returned to the water. After arriving back in France some 40 hours after she began her swim, Thomas, by now sleep-deprived, swollen from sea salt, stomach in open revolt, did something that's hard to imagine. She returned to the cool, dark water and made for England. The next day, more than 54 hours after beginning her swim, Thomas arrived at on the shore of Dover, bloated, caked, indistinct, leery-eyed, and barely able to stand, the first person in history to complete a four-way crossing of the English Channel. If anyone can explain the psychology of endurance, it should be Thomas. Only, as it turns out, explaining it is far different from living it. When people think of endurance sports, they often picture ultra-marathons, those sufferfests where competitors hurtle on through day and night, downing carbohydrate gels, taking 5-minute power naps, and grinding away until toenails fall off. To make it through, runners turn to different strategies. Ultramarathon champion Courtney Dowalter, a former science teacher in Colorado, famously enters what she calls the pain cave, envisioning an actual cave and herself in a hard hat, wielding a chisel, going to town, trying to make it a dust pile where I am there. Scott Jurek focuses on detaching from negative thoughts and embracing a flow state. Then there are the sustained feats of endurance, like the one attempted by the aptly named Marathon Monks of Mount Hiei near Kyoto, Japan, who run the equivalent of 1,000 marathons in 1,000 days in a quest to reach enlightenment. Those who succeed are honored as Daigyomin Ajari, or saintly master of the highest practice, revered for the extraordinary discipline and spiritual insight. But the marathons aren't even the hardest part. In one part of the trial, known as the Dori, monks must sit in constant prayer for nearly 10 days without food, water, or sleep, all under round-the-clock watch. During this phase, the monks say, the line between life and death becomes paper thin. Battling the depths. Wanting to push your limits is one thing. Getting your body to comply is another. Given the millennia of evolution have instilled a host of built-in biological kill switches and fail-safes. When I went searching for information, one of the first names that show up was Tim Noakes. A South African sports scientist, Noakes coined the idea of a central governor, a subconscious control center that monitors the body's internal signals and steps in to slow us down before we reach true physical danger. According to Noakes, we almost always stop well before we are actually out of energy. The brain's job is to protect us from ourselves. Noakes argued that this central governor acts preemptively, long before metabolic catastrophe strikes, limiting effort in anticipation of damage. If this sounds like a useful trait, well, most of the time, it is. It's what protects us from injury and calamity, unless, that is, you are purposely trying to push beyond those limits. Doing so requires finding a way to bypass or override that central governor. And as it happens, swimming provides a revealing canvas for exploring this quest. It's at night when the demons come out, those deep insecurities and self-limiting beliefs. Unlike running, climbing, and cycling, which offers external stimuli in the forms of terrain, scenery, aid stations, and other competitors, distance swimming is radically internal. You can hear virtually nothing. You stare down into murks for hours, days at a time. The sensory deprivation can be overwhelming. The earliest marathon swimmers have no issue overriding their regulator because they've already risked their lives with each swim. Unlike in running, you can't just stop and walk if you get tired in the middle of the ocean. Walk the beach in Dover, and you'll come across a statue of Matthew Webb, the first person successfully cross the channel unaided, a swaggering barrel-shaped British merchant seaman. Webb pulled it off in 1875 when shipwrecks and deaths at sea remained common. As a former sailor, he understood the risk intimately. While working on the Cunard line ship sailing between New York and Liverpool, Webb dove in when another sailor fell overboard. Though he couldn't save the man, the selfless act drew acclaim, and Webb won a prize from the Society for the Recovery of Persons Apparently Drowned. For this channel attempt, Webb wore a red swimming costume and slathered himself in a porpoise oil to guard against the cold. He breaststroked the entire 21-mile distance, fueling himself with beef tea, cod, liver oil, and regular swigs of brandy and other energy drinks handed to him by crewmen in a support boat. In the end, it took Webb nearly 22 hours to complete the swim, during which he dodged jellyfish and tides and creeping hallucinations. By the time he staggered ashore in Calais, barely able to stand, he had become an international sensation, and he lived out the rest of his days chasing grander and grander feats in the water until his final stunt, attempting to swim through the whirlpool-ridden rapids below Niagara Falls, proved fatal. His epitaph read, "Nothing great is easy," a fitting summary of the sport he helped launch. 50 years after Webb, Gertrude Erdely became the first woman to cross the channel, famously leading to one of the largest ticker tape parades in the history of New York City. 5 decades after her, Lincott showed up as a teenager to set a speed record. By the time of Sarah Thomas's 4-way attempt, a quartet of swimmers had successfully made a 3-way crossing, an American, a Brit, a New Zealander, and in 2015, Australian marathon swimmer Chloe McCardle, who spoke afterward of the long nights of the swim. It's at night when the demons come out, those deep insecurities and self-limiting beliefs. Thomas battle more than most. The marathon monks view endurance as a gateway of sorts. The idea is to exhaust the body and mind until nothing is left. When Thomas and I connected via Zoom, she told me that she first booked her channel attempt in 2017. She viewed it as a retirement swim of sorts. She was coming off years of open water feeds and about to set the world record for the longest continuous unassisted in current neutral swim in Lake Champlain, an astounding 104.6 miles. Having already crossed the channel, she now wanted to return to take a run at history. She booked a tide window 2 years out. Only 8 months after booking her slot, she was diagnosed with an aggressive form of breast cancer. 16 rounds of chemo, a mastectomy, 25 rounds of radiation. She kept swimming through much of it, dragging herself to the pool between infusions, even when she could barely lift her arms. It was the one thing that made me feel normal. By the time of her tide window In September 2019, her hair had only just grown back. Normally, Thomas could get in a zone where she swam, lost her own thoughts, what many open water swimmers call a moving meditation. The longer you are out there, the quieter everything gets. But after her mastectomy, doctors had put in a tissue expander as a temporary placeholder, lacking the time for another surgery before the channel. She had to swim with it in. It's like having a softball attached to your pec muscle, she said. Super uncomfortable. It also forces her to adjust her stroke, her right arm acting all wonky. The result? I tell people that I remember every single moment of the English Channel, because I couldn't get into that flow state. I was very present, and I did not want to be very present. The wisdom of slogging it out. In my conversations and research on endurance, a theme emerged. While the how may be hard to fathom, it's nonetheless relatively easy to explain. It involves muscle tissue and mantras and feed strategies. The why of it, that's the trickier part. What draws someone to override the brain's central governor to push past the point where every system screams for them to stop? For some, it's about learning through failure. That's the idea behind the Misoji challenge, or at least the modern interpretation of the Japanese tradition, taking on something hard, say a marathon swim, in which the odds of success are intentionally set around 50%. The premise? By pushing that limit, we learn the most about ourselves. The marathon monks view endurance as a gateway of sorts. The idea is to exhaust body and mind until nothing is left. At that point, as one of the monks explained to a journalist, when you are nothing, then something comes up to fill that space. That something, the monk said, is the vast consciousness that lies below the surface of our lives. That manifests differently for different people. Marathon swimmer Elaine Howley told me the story of her first swim to Catalina off the coast of California coast. I was terrified when I started, she said. You are launching at, 11 o'clock at night, jumping off a perfectly good boat into the middle of the Pacific. And there's things with teeth that live there. When she faltered during the long nights, her friend Howley jumped in to swim alongside her, yelling, "We don't make decisions in the dark." The idea? Never do something rash in your lowest moments. She continued, "As I just watched some flying fish go by, and they were being chased by sea lions. And then, of course, my brain goes to what's chasing the sea lions. But then she got in the water and caught some bioluminescence. Every time I put my hands in, I would get Star Wars warp speed lights off my hands, and I would be absolutely mesmerized. The lights pulled her out of her fear and into a space where I was like, this is so cool. The world is a pretty amazing place. She paused. And for me, it's such a good metaphor for life. I mean, life is hard. Life sucks sometimes. But then you get these moments of just sheer wonder and awe and beauty. And it's like, okay, I can keep slogging. Or, to put it another way, the more hard crap you do, the easier it is to do the hard shit. Thomas agreed. During the four-way crossing, salt water blasted up her nose and down her throat as she fought the current, too fatigued to breathe properly. She nailed a jellyfish with her face, and when she faltered during the long nights, her friend Howley jumped in to swim alongside her, yelling, "We don't make decisions in the dark." The idea? Never do something rash in your lowest moments. "You have to give me until sunrise before you quit," Hallie said. "Then see how you feel." That became Thomas's internal motivation. This sucks right now, but the sun will come up in a few hours, and we'll be fine. She pushed through, the sun rose, and then went down again, and then rose again. When she hit land in England, just after dawn, 54 hours after launching, a crowd awaited. Though the point-to-point swim is technically 80 miles due to current and tides, she actually covered 130. She celebrated with a glorious handful of peanut M&Ms. And over to the next article. Was Molly Pitcher a real person? This was written by Aaron Blakemore. During the darkest days of the American Revolution, women followed their husbands into war, aiding American troops with much-needed water and medical care, and bravely fighting alongside male soldiers during key battles. In American folklore, a woman nicknamed Molly Pitcher typified the grit and courage of these women who selflessly provided comfort to soldiers on the battlefield. Historians now believe Molly Pitcher is a historical myth, a composite folk figure who embodied the wartime experiences of multiple real-life women. Female volunteers played an important role on Revolutionary War battlefields, even though they were barred from formal military service and largely unrecognized for their efforts. And looking at the time, that's all the time I have for today. My name is Billy, and I've been reading you National Geographic for the Talking Information Center. Have a wonderful day, and thank you for listening.
You may not be aware that there are many ways to listen to your favorite programs from the Talking Information Center. You may call us at 781-834-4400 to inquire about receiving a special TIC radio receiver. Or visit our website, ticnetwork.org, and click the Listen Now button on the homepage. Or listen through your phone by calling 425-585-1901. If you are a T-Mobile or Metro PCS customer, call 605-475-0129. Or listen on Amazon's Alexa. Simply say, Alexa, play radio station Talking Information Center. Or listen on Google Home or Google Home Mini. Simply say, hey Google, play radio station Talking Information Center. Or you may listen by downloading our free app on your Apple or Android device. As you'll realize, there are many ways to access programming from the Talking Information Center these days. Choose the one that is right for you. If you would like any of this information repeated, please don't hesitate to call us at 781-834-4400 and we would be glad to assist you. Again, the number is 781-834-4400.
This is Birdnut. Spanish moss hangs eerily from cypress trees rising from the black water of a Louisiana bayou. The water ripples where a slender form glides just beneath the surface. At first glance, it appears to be a snake. But look closer, and you just might see a long, narrow spike of a beak at the tip of a slender neck. It's a snake bird, a colloquial name for the anhinga, swimming with just its head and neck above the water. Anhingas belong to a small group of birds called the darters, and they look a bit like cormorants. When hunting fish, an anhinga hangs motionless in the water, or swims slowly just below the surface, its neck crooked, almost like a cobra's. The anhinga has specialized muscles and a hinge in its neck. And when an unwary fish swims close, the bird's head darts forward, impaling its prey. Backward slanted serrations keep the fish from slipping off. Surfacing with its beak held just slightly open, the bird flicks the fish upward and catches it in midair. Then it downs it head first. And once again, the anhinga glides through the black water. As always, you'll find photos and videos on our website, birdnote.org. I'm Michael Stein.
You are listening to Audio Journal, a proud member of the Massachusetts Audio Information Network.